from God Almighty, that perhaps there was a reason why they exploded maybe earlier than the Israelis had expected, that the casualties, we're talking about maybe 12 or so, not more, who were killed as a result of this act. Of course, we have a huge number of wounded, but still the casualties, based on what we learned from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that it was not as the Israelis really wanted. But they are boasting that this is a huge achievement for them, whether at the intelligence level and even at the military level.
على مستوى إن كان هذا إنجاز أم ليس إنجاز نحن بنيجي بنقول هذا إنجاز على المستوى النظري.
As to whether this is an achievement or not, on a theoretical level, if you want to call it an achievement, it's a cheap one. This is not military work. I am part of the resistance, and during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and the support phase, my biggest concern was not to be targeted because of negligence or carelessness on my part. If I was struck by a drone while active in the field, that would be different. It's part of war. But this, to plant explosives in a civilian device, that's not warfare, that's treachery. That is pure malice and cowardice, avoiding direct confrontation because of an inability to fight us on the battlefield. This is a cowardly act. We told the enemy, come, use all your military tools and face us. I would know how to face it. For them to resort to this, it's backstabbing. This is more than cowardice and satanic, since they have no ability to face us directly. I am certain the enemy resorted to this because it cannot face us on the battlefield. This is certain. For 66 days, this was proven. So they resorted to cowardly methods. What I'm trying to say is, no matter what the result, this was not an achievement. Even if they had prepared 30,000 pages to explode, the outcome was still limited. We learned that 50,000 pages had reached Lebanon, and they were preparing to detonate 30,000. Every intelligence operation has a deadline. It could not be delayed longer. The pages reached us before Al-Aqsa Flood. I had received mine 2 weeks earlier. At a certain point, we already suspected something was wrong. The batteries would heat up and so on. The Israelis knew the resistance was growing suspicious. In the end, Israel was forced to detonate before reaching its target. Only 5,000 pages had been distributed. They had planned to hit tens of thousands, but only a few thousand devices were triggered, producing many wounded but very few martyrs. The purpose wasn't primarily to kill but to disable, to take these servicemen out of service. Why? Because they couldn't pack larger quantities of explosives without being detected. They can only put a few grams of explosives, not because they are merciful, but so they would not be detected. In military terms, there is something called a killing ambush. If I prepare such an ambush, the enemy could be caught in it and should not survive. But here Israel set its trap, which was a rare opportunity and a theoretical plot that can only happen once, and they spent so much on it and prepared for it. The result, however, as if out of 30, only 4 were actually hit. And even those 4 weren't eliminated. This was Israel's one-time opportunity to execute its diabolical scheme. But in actuality, they failed miserably. No matter how much they boast or how many golden pages they gift the great Satan, it was not the great achievement they claim, and they will never have another chance. Out of 4,000 wounded, how many were truly taken out of service? Only a few hundred at most. Many of those injured are still active, still present. Among the roughly 400 who sustained eye injuries, dozens, perhaps a few hundred, lost their sight. Yet even blindness did not take them out of service. They are still active, still strong, still fighting. We are followers of Ali ibn Abi Talib. We are followers of Maitam al-Tammar, who was crucified on a palm trunk, his limbs severed, his tongue cut out. Yet even then he remained a soldier confronting tyrants. If he had been alive and nailed to that tree, he would still be leading in jihad despite his wounds. That is our example.
المثقلي بالجراح المعلق على النخلة قائدا في جهاد التبيين كما كان قائدا في كل جبهات الجهاد.
I want to talk to you about how active you are now, despite the fact that you have lost your eyesight. But let me ask Zainab, how has your life changed? I mean, as a woman, as someone who was engaged, getting ready for marriage, getting ready for a new life, how has this act and this, these wounds, how have they changed your life and the life of your family?
No one can deny that life has changed. Someone who once went and came freely, who others relied on, now must rely on others. Of course, my life has changed. But this experience has made us stronger and taught us many things. We cannot be weak. The enemy's goal was not to kill. If that had been the goal, they would have put more explosives. Their aim was to paralyze these 4,000 people so they would be a burden on their resistance. But as I have seen from my own experience and from sitting with other wounded, this attack only increased our strength and determination to go on. Even recently, some of the injured sat for official exams and ranked among the top in Lebanon. Israel may have been closed one door of jihad for us, but we are searching for other doors through our wounds to continue. Surely this injury is not an obstacle. I was engaged, and after the attack, this did not stop me and my partner from staying together and having a family. We will continue, we will build families, and those families will also fight Israel. This only creates more hatred and enmity between us and Israel, especially for the women who were injured. It is usually the men who are wounded in battle, but women will have even greater determination than the men because of the oppression against them.
Let me come back to you, Rida. You have you're very active now, even in your current state. You have your own program on one of the local radio stations, political satire, and you're saying that you can do so much. There's so much that you can do. And some people would say that someone in your status would need not only medical care, but also psychological care. But it seems from your friends and family who I spoke to, they told me that you are the one who is giving them this type of support. So where do you get this strength?
On the psychological level, I want to say something. Perhaps one could see it as coming from God. I had just turned 40, and I felt I had lived much of my life in sacrifice for the sake of God. I had spent years on the front lines. I used to pray, asking God to draw me closer to Him. I felt that in the routine of my daily work, my heart was not being purified enough. What I needed was not a small shake, but a strong one. So I asked God for this strong shake, but I did not know through which door it would come. When the pager rang, the enemy wanted to be a door to my physical and spiritual death. I do not believe they could truly kill us with a pager or with a landmine. These devices are mechanically limited. They can only carry so much material. Their aim was to kill our bodies and also our spirits. But I saw that ringing sound instead as a bell calling me to a new door of God's mercy and kindness. The first thing I did when others went to fetch a car was to throw myself on the ground. I didn't collapse. I deliberately lay down and said, "My Lord, praise be to you. What I had been asking for, it seems you answered. I didn't know which door you would choose, but if this is it, I submit to you." I told him, "This life you gave me, I offer it back to you as a sacrifice in your path. If you still want me to remain, leave me here to be active, present, and pleasing you. But allow me to do something. But if my time is over, then let me go to you while bleeding in peace." Yet, at that moment, I felt strongly that God wanted me to stay, and He had given me the blessing of sight. And though the enemy tried to take it away, He would restore it. Indeed, within 2 months after surgeries, I regained my vision. More recently, after further operations, I could no longer see, but I am certain in my heart that I will regain my sight, and this is God's promise to me, and I have full trust in Him. On the level of morale, my principle is, the more positive spirit I spread among those around me, the more strength returns to me. I push myself forward. I show others that I am still active and capable, so they will trust my ability to cope. At the same time, I do not pretend to be a superhero. I tell people honestly, I lost some abilities, but I search for ways to compensate. I lost the ability to perform one function, but I gained the ability to perform many others. During this stage, I read about the lives of many great figures who were blind, yet still highly influential. While I was laying in the hospital just a week after, I began reading again. I began planning the new course of my life, how I would rebuild it, on what foundations and with what mission. I took inspiration from others who had been tested by different hardships and still managed to rise again. I adopted one guiding rule. What did I lose? How will I compensate? And how will I build a new path? At every step, there is a new challenge to overcome. We were raised to see every obstacle as a challenge. And when challenged, we are provoked to rise and surpass it. This is what our leaders taught us. This is how we were raised, in the resistance and in life.
Zainab, what is your message to the world, to leaders, to the leaders of Lebanon, for example?
Like Rida said, God could have chosen me to be a martyr. When the explosion occurred, sometimes I lamented asking God, why didn't you allow me to be a martyr? But then I was convinced that God kept me alive because I have a message and I have an important role in this life. If I had no role, then God would have taken me. Now I have changed. I was the timid Zainab that almost never spoke out on television. Now I need to tell the world about the oppression I'm living and to show how unethical and cowardice this enemy really is, causing such a massacre. Disregarding the targeting of women and children, I want to show the world that facing this immoral enemy, we are strong and we will not be weakened or intimidated, and we will not allow the enemy to achieve its goal.
Thank you. Rida, final question for you. We mentioned that you're also a political analyst. You're not just a writer and a poet. And your show shows how, in a few minutes, you can let people understand the political situation in Lebanon, maybe more than in any other way. How do you see the future now? And do you think that Israel fears Rida Ruz now, the wounded, more than it feared Rida Ruz before?
There is a trending statement that is used these days, which is restricting state control or reinstating the full authority of the government in Lebanon. It's remarkable that the main question on our minds, which is asked by citizens in all of Lebanon, from the north to the south, where is the government? This question, if asked in any other country, would not be normal or logical. But in Lebanon, it's very logical to ask where the government is when the roads are cut, but the policeman is giving tickets. Where is the government when the electricity comes once a year, like a holiday, but an employee comes to give you the electricity bill? The same question is asked in the banks, the hospitals, the schools, and government institutions. In all places where the government should be, you will ask that question, but you will not find it because it's not there. It's only a formal decor of a government which is not even decorated. Now they tell us, hand over your weapons because the government has to restrict authority. I told them, other issues can be solved in politics. You take people's money from the banks, you don't provide good health care, the school system is down, and there are no good roads even. I can't find the government to help, but there's an alternative to these issues. But when you want to take my arms, that's a different matter. In 1982, when we waited for the government, we saw the Israelis reach Beirut and the government was on top of the Israeli tank. Now, if we ask that question in the south, it will be an existential question. We will be killed and see that the government is stabbing us in the back. We never found it fighting with us in the south. We will give you the weapons on one condition, that you don't find anyone asking, where is the government? I was 16 when I wrote a booklet of poetry. I never loved taking up arms, and it wasn't my hobby to fight. God told us you will have to fight even if you despise it. The verses in the Holy Quran talk about fighting as a reaction. This is our fight. They are professional killers, but we are good defenders. If you ask me, I never wanted to hold a gun, but I was forced to leave my love of writing poetry, plays, and movie scripts, and even having a chance of directing. I had a dream to work in this profession, and my personality is not that of a soldier. But I cannot be a hypocrite and write poetry and plays about the resistance and not be a resistance fighter. I need to be honest with myself. Perhaps God has taken something from me, as if he is telling me to use all my time now to accomplish my goal. I respect the martyrs killed in battle under fire, but I also highly respect those who were killed by Israel because they took up pens and spoke out. I respect Najil Ali and other novelists and writers who the Israelis felt threatened by the words they wrote. Yes, I tell the Israelis that now I will be more dangerous to you. Now I have time for you. Netanyahu will die and I will remain. Try to kill me now. I will do everything in my power to uncover your reality to the world.
Inshallah. Zainab, you wanted to add something?
I wanted to comment on the issue of the government. We did not hear a clear denouncement from the government for what happened to us. No one reached out to help us. It is unfortunate. At the same time, we are grateful to the Islamic Republic of Iran, which took us and gave us the treatment and medical care we needed.
Zainab Musrah, thank you very much for being with us. Rida Riz, thank you so much for sharing your stories, which I think have touched the hearts and minds of people all over the world. I want to thank us for joining us on this very special edition. Goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
NATO deployed three French fighter jets to eastern Poland on Friday as a so-called deterrent against Russia. Many analysts argue that it is the Western Alliance's expansion that sparked the conflict in Ukraine. The European Commission has unveiled its 19th sanctions package targeting Moscow's energy, banking and high-tech sectors.
We are working on a new solution to finance Ukraine's defense efforts. This is based on the immobilized Russian assets. We must be very clear, this is Russia's war, and the perpetrator must pay for it.
But inside the European Parliament, critics warn that hard-pressed EU taxpayers are footing the bill.
The EU has spent 169 billion euros on the war so far, and the new seven-year budget would add another 100 billion euros. Up to 20% of the EU budget could go to Ukraine.
Some claim that one of the main beneficiaries of the war is the United States.
Socialismo. We used to buy cheap energy from the Russians, and today we are spending 700 billion euros to buy that same energy from Washington. The EU has also failed on weapons, which we buy from the United States to give to Ukraine.
There's no doubt that natural gas sanctions imposed by Brussels have hit the EU much harder than Russia, leading to soaring European energy costs while Moscow was able to find alternative markets. Then, thanks to high global oil and gas prices, the Kremlin was able to offset the economic squeeze intended by the EU. Several of the EU's 27 government leaders are expected to oppose the bloc's latest sanctions package against Russia.
It remains hard to see how the European Union is going to respond because the member states remain divided over the issue. But 19 rounds of sanctions do not have the effect.
And a growing number of EU lawmakers are questioning double standards, asking why no tough measures have been imposed on Israel over its genocide in Gaza. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That the United Kingdom formally recognises the state of Palestine.
Nearly eight decades late and short on details, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer announcing in a pre-recorded speech that his country now recognises Palestine as a state.
Mr. Speaker, as I say,
it was a fraud announcement drawing criticism at home and abroad. Critics at home saying the recognition is more about managing divisions in Westminster than anything else.
As Britain continues to arm, fund, finance Israel's genocide of our people, I find, quite frankly, their recognition of a Palestinian state as empty as their calls for a ceasefire while they continue to participate in the genocide of our people.
Other attacks expectedly came from the Israeli regime and chief backer, the United States. 80 neocon hawks threatening Britain with punitive measures ahead of the announcement.
Hamas even refused.
While Starmer spent much of his speech focusing a lot on Hamas, its future, and the Israeli captives held by the group, he made no mention of what a Palestinian state would look like or of the thousands of Palestinians held hostage by Israel.
What they are actually doing is consolidating the gains made by the Zionist entity, which includes the absolute annihilation of Gaza, the continued terrorism that is being taken place by Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And what they actually want to do is consolidate the 80-odd years of Zionist settler colonialism.
The so-called two-state solution was brokered by the U.S. in the 1990s, but failed to produce two states. Critics say it was dead on arrival.
So I think we need to rip that idea up and to start again. And what we're campaigning for is a one-state solution with equal rights for all citizens. But, of course, there has to be a reckoning for the Zionist leadership, and indeed there has to be a de-Zionization process to de-radicalize the population.
Three countries announced their recognition of Palestine today. More are expected to follow suit at the UN General Assembly meeting soon. But it's at the UN Security Council where it should be approved as a fully fledged state. And that's where the US has the veto power. While the British government hails this as a historic move, critics say it changes absolutely nothing. Western weapon supplies are ongoing, the genocide in Gaza is raging, and illegal settlement expansion going on unabated, and that the promise of a Palestinian state, if not followed up by action, is little more than an empty gesture. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Yemen's Minister of Defense, Mohammed al-Atafi, has fired back after an Israeli official threatened to assassinate the leader of Ansarullah movement, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, should Sana'a persist in its missile strikes against sensitive Israeli targets in support of Palestinians. Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Israel Katz, issued the threat on a social media post, prompting a response from Yemeni officials.
The Israeli enemy has obviously been hit hard from Yemen. This is why they are engaging in ridiculous statements to protect their image after it suffered tremendously at the hands of the Yemeni armed forces. What's to come in the future will be even more powerful attacks against Israel and any nation thinking about attacking us.
Military officials also sent a stern warning to Arab states aiding the Israeli regime.
Our message to the Arab states that are thinking about aiding the Zionist enemy in continuing the genocide in Gaza or helping the Zionist enemy in attacking Yemen is, proceed with extreme caution. Our retaliation will send shockwaves. Therefore, they need to take heed of this warning and not aid the Israeli regime in any way.
Some Yemeni officials said, no matter what Israel does or says, it will not deter Yemen from its support to Gaza and solidarity with the Palestinian cause.
The statement made by our Minister of Defense is a reply to the statements made by Israeli officials. The message is that nothing Israel says will change the Yemeni position and that the Yemeni armed forces will continue to support Gaza. Our message to the nations helping Israel like Saudi Arabia is, you are entering a losing battle.
For Yemen's leaders, Israeli threats of attacking their capital or assassinating their commanders will be met not with silence, but with shockwaves.
The warning from Yemen should be taken seriously. After all, the Yemeni armed forces have demonstrated repeatedly its reach and capabilities against Israeli and international targets, including Aramco oil facilities in Saudi Arabia. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
In the rolling hills of Farha, determination runs deeper than the roots of its olive trees. Here, dozens of Palestinians joined by local solidarity groups have taken part in a voluntary Solidarity Day aimed at protecting their land and reinforcing their presence. They worked side by side, clearing fields, planting trees, and rehabilitating communal spaces, all under the shadow of growing Israeli settlement activity nearby. For residents, this is not just a gesture of environmental care. It is an act of resistance against ongoing attempts to erase their identity and uproot them from their homeland.
Today marks a voluntary Solidarity Day, the peak of many campaigns we launched in our village to resist the settlement assault. We are working to protect our water springs and farmlands, to stand firm on our land and strengthen our presence. This day is about reinforcing Palestinian resilience, because sadly, our options are limited. Here in the village, we express our steadfastness and our will to remain.
In Farha, the struggle is about water, land, and survival. Settlement expansion has robbed the village of its vital resources, but presence on the land remains an act of defiance and belonging. These activities not only help the farmers, but also enhance their ability to be on their land and decrease the sense of abandonment.
Voluntary campaigns like this are vital for farmers to stay on their land, especially with attacks on fields and springs. This spring is strategic, and our presence helps curb settler encroachment.
Even children's voices carry a deep sense of ownership over the land, showing that even the youngest see protecting water springs and farmland as duty, not a choice.
I am here today to restore Ain Badran, to protect it from the occupation. Settlers could take it, and the nearby lands as well. Even as a child, I know this is our country and our land, and it's our duty to preserve it.
Relentless settler violence and ongoing land confiscation, every tree planted, every spring restored, is an assertion that their presence and rights to the land cannot be erased.
From the hills of Farha, what may seem like a simple day of planting is in fact a powerful statement of steadfastness. Here, Palestinians are turning collective action into a tool of resistance, rooting themselves deeper into the land that continues to define their struggle. Naqa Hamid, Farha, Occupied West Bank.
NATO deployed three French fighter jets to eastern Poland on Friday as a so-called deterrent against Russia. Many analysts argue that it is the Western Alliance's expansion that sparked the conflict in Ukraine. The European Commission has unveiled its 19th sanctions package targeting Moscow's energy, banking and high-tech sectors.
We are working on a new solution to finance Ukraine's defense efforts. This is based on the immobilized Russian assets. We must be very clear, this is Russia's war, and the perpetrator must pay for it.
But inside the European Parliament, critics warn that hard-pressed EU taxpayers are footing the bill.
The EU has spent 169 billion euros on the war so far, and the new seven-year budget would add another 100 billion euros. Up to 20% of the EU budget could go to Ukraine.
Some claim that one of the main beneficiaries of the war is the United States.
Socialismo. We used to buy cheap energy from the Russians, and today we are spending 700 billion euros to buy that same energy from Washington. The EU has also failed on weapons, which we buy from the United States to give to Ukraine.
There's no doubt that natural gas sanctions imposed by Brussels have hit the EU much harder than Russia, leading to soaring European energy costs while Moscow was able to find alternative markets. Then, thanks to high global oil and gas prices, the Kremlin was able to offset the economic squeeze intended by the EU. Several of the EU's 27 government leaders are expected to oppose the bloc's latest sanctions package against Russia.
It remains hard to see how the European Union is going to respond because the member states remain divided over the issue. But 19 rounds of sanctions do not have the effect.
And a growing number of EU lawmakers are questioning double standards, asking why no tough measures have been imposed on Israel over its genocide in Gaza. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new poll shows that President Donald Trump is losing the support of the largest unofficial political party in the United States, independent voters. A latest top survey found that 57% of all Americans now disapprove of Trump's performance, a record low for his second term. Trump's approval could fairly be said to be at its lowest point in either of his two terms. His net approval rating of minus 18 points is the second lowest ever recorded for him, and many pollsters disregard the accuracy of a minus 21 approval rating recorded in November 2017.
I think there's so much going on that it's really hard to even start. But one of the biggest things is he just keeps skirting the line of what's appropriate. And every single time that he gets closer to that line, getting towards inappropriate, he's just getting so close. And everyone knows the game that he's playing. And the game that he's playing is, how much can I get away with? And nobody likes that.
I didn't approve of him when he came in for the second term. Certainly his attacks on our freedoms, attacking organizations like this who are standing up and speaking against him. And, of course, what he's doing, under the guise of, undocumented immigration and detaining people without cause and just all the, all the rhetoric.
Trump's low approval rating is also being attributed to the recent assassination of an Islamophobic but very popular right-wing commentator, which many are calling a watershed moment in increasingly violent American politics.
The assassination has led to increased calls for anti-Trump protesters to be stopped, arrested, investigated, and even deported. That has many accusing the administration of using McCarthyite tactics to silence freedom of speech.
I think a lot of people are afraid to come out. You oppose Trump, you get primaried and knocked out of office, or you oppose Trump and you get a pizza sent to your house saying, I know where you and your wife and your kids live. And, it's just total dictatorship.
Despite being the richest country in the world, inequality in America is so rampant that a recent study found that 67% of workers live paycheck to paycheck. That's an almost 7% increase since just last year, and the poll only represents people who are employed. Last week, jobless claims hit a four-year high. Polls show that price inflation and jobs are the two most important issues for voters. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
Heroes of the 8-year Holy Defense. The first of the Iranian month of Mehr that fell on September 22nd in 1980 was the day on which, without any provocation, Saddam of the repressive Baath minority regime of Baghdad, on the orders of the U.S., launched a full-scale ground, sea, and aerial invasion of the Islamic Republic of Iran in a bid to seize the oil-rich border lands and to overthrow the dynamic system of government established by the sage of the age, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul. The elaborate plots of the invaders soon went awry when Iranian Muslims, on the instructions of the father of the Islamic Revolution, rallied to the war fronts to stage epics and blunt the full-fledged aggression, although the war dragged on for 8 years because of tens of billions of dollars poured into Saddam's coffers by his Arab reactionary backers and accomplices, mainly Saudi regime and the regime in Kuwait, as well as the military hardware provided to him by global arrogance led by the great Satan, the U.S. Please stay with us for the first part of a new daily series on the occasion titled Heroes of the Holy Defense. There are brilliant epics in the history of every nation in view of the resolve of the people to offer self-sacrifice for defending the honor of their country and religion. Without the least doubt, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one such nation which, infused by the grassroots movement of the people at a time when the world was divided between capitalist West and the communist East, gained victory with the slogan, "Neither East nor West, Islam is the best." The U.S. and its accomplices viewed the emergence of a strong, independent, and Islamic Iran as a danger to their vested interests in the region and hatched a wide variety of plots in a bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic system of government. They backed the anti-revolutionaries and terrorists of all hue and color by attempting to spread seditions and separatist currents in some border provinces, such as Kurdistan and Khuzestan. Their plots, however, failed thanks to Iran's committed youths that got together to form the Basij Mobilization Forces and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps for the defense of the country and to safeguard the achievements of the Islamic Revolution at a time when the regular armed forces were being purged of officers influenced by the U.S. and the enemies of Islam and Iran. These popular forces, after defeating the seditious and separatist moves, fully displayed their commitment and religious national aspirations by enacting epics throughout the 1,200-kilometer-long border with Iraq to defeat the armed-to-the-teeth Baathist war machine. The memories of these immortal heroes who sacrificed their limbs and life are alive today. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rightly hailed these heroes of Islam and Iran, since jihad is one of the basic tenets of Islam. The late ideologue of the Islamic Revolution, martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, had said in this regard, "Islam is not a religion that says if someone slapped your face on the right, offer the left to him for another slap. It considers defense of faith necessary, and as is evident in the Holy Quran, in order to safeguard faith, one should either migrate from that land or, if he has the means, should organize jihad against the devilish forces." Thus, in view of these facts and as per the dynamics of Islam, Iranian youths not only rallied to the fronts for liberating the occupied parts of their homeland from the Baathists, but for defending their faith and revolution embarked on efforts in various fields to make the country self-sufficient. One of the leading defenders of the country on the battlefield was Dr. Mustafa Chamran. he undoubtedly remains one of the immortal heroes of the Holy Defense. Born into a religious family on March 8, 1932 in Tehran to Hassan Chamran Savoji, who was originally from Chamran village of Save, after completing his preliminary studies, he graduated from Tehran University's College of Technology in the field of electromechanics. After a year's teaching, he won scholarship for higher studies in the U.S., where he obtained his Ph.D. in electrical engineering and plasma physics in 1963 from the University of California, Berkeley. Parallel to his scientific and academic pursuits, Chamran was active in the political and social fields as a person who from his youth was a committed Muslim, having been one of the first members of Tehran University Students Islamic Society. In the U.S. also, he founded many revolutionary societies and organizations such as the Iranian Students Society, the Iranian Students Islamic Society, and Islamic Society of Muslim Students. He worked for a while at one of the NASA-related research centers in the U.S. named Bell Laboratory, where he was active in the field of satellites, guided missiles, and three-dimensional. Because of his political activities against the despotic Pahlavi regime, his work in the U.S. was cut short, forcing him to go to Egypt, where he obtained guerrilla warfare training for 2 years. In 1965, he went to Lebanon and became a prominent assistant to Imam Musa Sadr. He helped found the Movement of the Deprived and then the Amal organization for fighting the Zionist entity. The third phase of Dr. Chamran's life started after the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He returned after 21 years of life abroad and put his scientific and revolutionary experiences in the service of the country. He strove to groom the first group of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Then, as Deputy Prime Minister for Revolutionary Affairs, he bravely embarked on nullifying the anti-revolutionary plots. His unforgettable epic in organizing resistance in the city of Parver in Kurdistan is legendary. One of the missions entrusted to him by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, was to free the army and popular forces from the siege of anti-revolutionaries in Parver. He admirably discharged his duties and liberated Parver. The Imam appointed him the Minister of Defense, and he spared no efforts for organizing the country's defense. Dr. Chamran was not seeking power, wealth, and fame. For this reason, on the outbreak of the Iraqi war, he went to the war fronts to set up irregular war headquarters in Ahwaz, the capital of Khuzestan province, for countering the Ba'athist army. Dr. Mustafa Chamran succeeded in preventing the advance of the Ba'athists, and in some regions he managed to drive them back. This well-known soldier of Islam was finally martyred in one of his missions on the battlefield and gained his cherished wish of martyrdom in the path of God. Imam Khomeini, in a message on the occasional martyrdom of Dr. Chamran, said, "Chamran spent a lifetime from start to end with a grand divine purpose and a pure and untainted ideology without attachment to any political groups and bands. His life was dedicated to gaining the light of divine knowledge and earning proximity to God, and he strove on that path and sacrificed his life for it. He lived and died in honor. May his soul be joyous and may he be always remembered."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillahi kamathali hab بَتِنْ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلٍ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ فِي كُلِّ سُنْبُلَةٍ مِئَةُ حَبَّةٍ والله يضاعف لمن يشاء